Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters Today on March 6, 2005. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois, here on WILL-AM 580. Today we're going to be talking about a subject near and dear to the heart of many in this community, universities and the relationship they have with commercial values, the market, business, and corporate funding. Closely related to many of the issues we've talked about concerning media in this country, but a subject near and dear to those in this community, and I think of importance equal to that of the media in the big scheme of things. Today we'll be talking with an expert on this subject in her new book, Jennifer Washburn, the guest we'll have. So join us today, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
New U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez set out some strange priorities in a recent speech to the Republican-friendly Hoover Institution, his first semi-public address outside the U.S. Justice Department since being sworn in on Valentine's Day. According to Gonzalez, cracking down on the porn industry is just as much a priority for him as fighting the war on terror. In Congress, the House of Representatives has passed what's called the Broadcast Decency Act, which increases the minimum FCC fine for indecency by more than 15-fold. Not to be outdone, the United States Senate is working up a bill to expand FCC prohibitions against naughty words and images to satellite and cable broadcasts, which have been exempt from indecency regulation because they are subscription-based and not publicly accessible.
On March 29th, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a lawsuit that pits movie and record companies against file-sharing systems, consumer media recording device makers, and free speech advocates. More than 60 parties filed briefs in the case of MGM versus Grokster, which seeks to pin liability for the unauthorized copying and distribution of copyrighted material on the makers of software and services which enable file sharing to take place. Such liability would provide easier targets for music and movie companies to sue, instead of the current strategy involving batch lawsuits against individual file sharers. Mark Cooper, research director at the Consumer Federation of America, says the case involves a rehash of principles first articulated in 1984 during a temporary panic over video recorders.
Hollywood insisted that VCRs would destroy their industry, and they literally tried to outlaw the VCR. The court said, no, we're not going to find it as an illegal technology as long as it has substantial usage that don't infringe copyrights. And Congress also did nothing. And in the ensuing 20 years, Hollywood makes almost 40% of its revenue off of VCRs and DVDs.
Record labels, movie studios, and recording artists such as the Dixie Chicks, the Eagles, and Elvis Costello claim that file-sharing programs are used so heavily to infringe copyrights that it takes money out of their pockets. But Cooper says that claim has no empirical evidence to stand on.
The test is not whether some infringement would happen. The test is whether there's so much infringement that it would harm or undermine the economic viability of the industry. And that's absolutely not the case.
The studios and labels lost in the lower courts basically because they failed to prove that the primary task of file sharing systems is the circumvention of copyright. Cooper says it's anyone's guess which way this case may go.
The original Sony decision, which kept the VCR in the world, was a 5-4 decision, and it took two oral arguments for the court to decide.
So far, the Recording Industry Association of America has filed suit against more than 7,000 people for sharing copyrighted works online. The Motion Picture Association of America launched its first round of lawsuits against file sharers in November, targeting at least 50 people around the country.
Incumbent telecom providers are getting down and dirty in their desperation to stop community internet projects like municipal broadband. In Lafayette, Louisiana, Bell South has filed a lawsuit against the city in an attempt to stop it from building a municipal fiber optic network. This is not the first time Bell South's resorted to the courts to try and stop a community internet project. Last year, it sued a city in North Carolina but lost the case on appeal in January. Perhaps that's why a Bell South official hinted that a Lafayette-based call center that currently employs 1,300 people might close unless the city dropped its fiber network plans. City parish officials call the suggestion, quote, economic blackmail, although Bell South has since backpedaled, saying its insinuation had been misinterpreted. And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. American children and adolescents watch 22 to 28 hours of television per week. On average, they spend more time in front of the tube than doing anything else except sleeping. By the time most American children finish the first grade, they will have spent the equivalent of 3 school years in front of the television. So it should come as no surprise that almost half of all parents report that their kids are already asking for brand name products by age 5, and 1 out of 5 say their kids begin asking for brand name products by the age of 3. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke, welcome back to Media Matters, where we've just hung our flag at half-mast, thanks to the results out of Columbus. So no trip to Willard Airport today, fans. Stay at home, stay listening to the radio, to Media Matters. We've got a terrific show for you today. One of the common themes of this program over the last 3 years has been talking with scholars and journalists and public figures about how commercial factors have negatively affected the quality of journalism and public life in the United States. And we've also talked at some length about how commercialism has pervaded childhood and media and education, K through 12 education, and the negative effects that has had. Today we're going to turn to yet another related subject, but one very close to the first two, which is the corporate involvement with higher education, specifically universities, and most directly, research universities. And we're fortunate to have, as a guest on Media Matters today, Jennifer Washburn, the author of a brand new book published by Basic Books called University Inc., the Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. Jennifer, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's good to be here.
Well, it's terrific to have you. I've had the pleasure of reading your book over the past 2 days, and it's a terrific read. You clearly are not an academic. You're a journalist because it reads so well.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you. I worked hard on that, I must say.
And this is your first book, I take it?
It is my first book. That's right.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And how long has it been out?
You know, it came out officially on February 15th, so it is still a baby.
Yeah, it's not even a month old. Yeah, it's very, very much an infant. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, why you decided to do the book and what drove you to the book and then what the book's about.
Yeah, well, I mean, the title, I suppose, says a lot. It's University Inc. I mean that quite seriously. I think universities are... There are really two things happening. One is that universities are drawing more and more of their support from private industry, and increasingly that money comes with strings attached. Just a quick example, Kmart endowed a chair at West Virginia University, which required its holder to spend up to 30 days a year actually training store managers. But there are also all kinds of other interferences that industry has made into academic research, delays on publication, proprietary restrictions on research, insisting that they be allowed to review and edit manuscripts prior to publication. But the second problem is that universities themselves are starting to look and behave much more like for-profit entities as opposed to educational institutions. And they are actually trying to profit off of their research in ways that are unprecedented, in the history of higher education.
And I take it from reading the book, this is not a good thing in your mind. That introducing such explicit market values is not a healthy development for higher education.
No, I think it really isn't. I mean, I do want to stress that although I really do take on and criticize the growing collaborations between university and industry, it's not that these are in and of themselves a bad thing. Universities have always collaborated with the private sector. They've always transferred their knowledge to industry, and that's been very important for society. Obviously, we wouldn't benefit from this research if private industry couldn't translate it into new drugs or new products that we can benefit from. The problem, though, is that commercial values have intruded into the university in ways that are corrupting the academic research sphere and the whole mission of higher education.
We're talking to Jennifer Washburn today, author of the new book, University, Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here of Media Matters. We do have phone lines open. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. In the book, Jennifer Washburn, you walk through the history of American colleges and universities, and really, if you don't mind, could you give us sort of a brief summary of sort of how universities evolved in American life, and then the decisive developments first in the post-war period and then in the 1980s?
Sure. I mean, essentially, you know, dating back to the mid-19th century, as I just mentioned, universities had close ties to industry, whole departments. The rise of chemical engineering or electrical engineering, for example, rose in tandem with those industries. The difference is that universities then saw their mission as to, you know, produce this new knowledge and transfer it to the commercial sector to develop commercially. That the university never involved itself in commercial activities explicitly itself.
If I can ask you just to back up on that one point, I mean, by transfer, it was sort of in the public domain and anyone could use it in the private sector?
That's right. You know, the notion was that universities were very committed to publishing their research, to making it broadly available. Sometimes it was transferred just via relationships and collaborations with, mm-hmm. with people in the private sector. So it was always through the public domain. Then, you know, we certainly saw a huge growth of government support for higher education after World War II. And that was really critical. Actually, the government had refrained from funding research at the university, believing that it might corrupt the academic mission. Mm-hmm. And so it was only after World War II that the federal government started to put a significant amount of U.S. taxpayer funding into the universities. It's important to note, though, that although there have been abuses and that government has certainly, we know about the McCarthy era, we know that there was too much money flowing into the universities from the defense departments, and that did skew the research. By and large, the federal government had an enormous awareness of the need to preserve an academic research sphere that was autonomous. And that's why we developed this whole peer review system where, you know, researchers would apply for federal research grants, and those grants would be determined based on merit and based on scientific peer review, as opposed to being decided based on political criteria.
So the system worked, in other words, for the most part.
By and large, it worked. I mean, as I say, there is the important caveat that so much of the research was flowing, so much of the funding was coming from these mission agencies, the various different defense agencies, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the DOD had a certain mission, as did the NIH. And so the significant problem with government funding in terms of skewing was that not enough funding was coming through the National Science Foundation, which was dedicated to pure research. The National Science Foundation didn't get created until the 1950s, and so that was largely responsible for that skewing. But as I say, yes, by and large, the system did work well. What happened, though, speeding forward, is that in the late 1970s, when the U.S. was facing growing competition from Germany and Japan, the U.S. Congress had this idea that what they would do would be to pass new legislation known as the Bayh-Dole Act, which gave universities automatic intellectual property rights to federally funded research. This Bayh-Dole Act actually had very noble intentions. The idea was that it would encourage universities to transfer knowledge to industry more quickly, and that this would fuel innovation in this country, and it would help propel the U.S. out of the doldrums of the 1970s. Unfortunately, what no one considered at the time was what the effect would be on the academic research culture. For the first time, universities were actually allowed to patent federally funded taxpayer research and license it to industry and to gather the royalty revenue that they could generate. And so it gave them a direct profit interest in their own professors' research that had never existed before.
We're talking to Jennifer Washburn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jennifer Washburn is the author of the brand new book, just 3 weeks since it hit the shelves, University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line four, Eureka, you're on the air with Jennifer Washburn.
Thank you very much. You began to touch on the area that I'm concerned about, and that is the relationship of the CIA and the whole federal government defense apparatus to research in higher education. And I don't know if I heard it during the time I was in college in the Vietnam War, but it said something like half of all funding for defense was done by universities or anything. Could you comment upon, if you know, what the approximate amount may be now, and has it gotten any better or any worse as far as universities doing research and collaboration with the CIA?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't give you any up-to-date figures on that. So much of the focus of my book is on this growing commercial relationship with universities. And so, certainly we know that in the wake of 9/11 and, you know, once again, government funding is veering back toward more applied research into, you know, various different anti-terrorism initiatives, and so the federal government is always going to the research is going to be skewed, and there are certain priorities that get shaped and formed. My argument is that as flawed as the government funding can be, it is worked out through democratic processes, which, you know, may not always be what we would like to see, but this is qualitatively different than when industry funds research, and the research by and large is geared towards serving the bottom line of one particular company.
Let me just do a follow-up on this, Jennifer, and I didn't really see this in the book, but one of the initiatives of the Bush administration and probably administrations before it has been to privatize more and more of the military operations in the United States and outsource to firms what had been government activities. Are some of these companies, and I'm thinking of Halliburton, but there are many others, are they playing a role on university campuses as well? So maybe a privatized military firms coming in and doing research?
You know, I really have not seen that. I don't know how much actual research Halliburton is really funding.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But certainly there are any number of areas where you're seeing large companies. I mean, Stanford University recently launched a multi-million-dollar center on global climate change, which is heavily funded by ExxonMobil and other oil and energy companies. And those companies actually have a say in determining which academic research projects are going to receive funding. So when you see Stanford University start to allow industry to exert that kind of control over a center whose specific focus is global climate change, I find that troubling.
Well, in fact, that's just one of numerous examples the book is filled with and stories you tell about a degree of corruption, frankly, that I was surprised to see. And I've been working in research universities for more than two decades now. In terms of professors actually, you know, being paid to take positions but not even acknowledging publicly they're being paid to take these positions. So we think we're getting credible vouched for a scholarship on something when, in fact, it's paid for much like a testimonial and advertisement.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a pretty alarming case. Charles Nemiroff, who is the chair of the psychiatry department at Emory University, was invited by a very prestigious medical journal, Nature Neuroscience, to review about two dozen experimental psychiatric treatments. When the journal invited the chair of the psychiatry department at Emory University to do this, they really thought that they would be getting his expert opinion based on scientific merit. Well, it turned out later in 2003, we learned that Nemiroff, three of the experimental treatments that he endorsed in his publication actually were ones that he had a direct financial interest in, including a lithium patch that he held the patent to. And none of these financial ties, these financial interests in these products, were publicly disclosed in his review article, and nor were his substantial other ties to drug manufacturers.
It seems like the book really concentrates heavily on how much money there is in science and technology areas of research to the exclusion largely of humanities, and then within science and technology, the amount of money that the corporate influence and commercial influence, specifically in drug and healthcare issues, struck me as just overwhelming. Even.
Yeah. No. There's no question that the money, the industry money, is pouring into the fields that have the most commercial viability, and so where we're seeing industry's influence most is in, you know, medicine, biotechnology, agricultural fields where there's a lot of industry money going into genetically modified crop production. But at the same time, you're seeing shifting of university research resources away from all of the fields, the humanities, the social sciences. Some of the core of the undergraduate curriculum is being significantly underfunded. You're seeing suddenly philosophy and religion and political science all being merged into one lump department, whereas they used to be three separate disciplines.
Where are you seeing that?
You know, actually, I can't tell you where that is, but I've
is got that proprietary
I can no longer recall
oh,
there,
okay.
that specific case. But you are. It is a phenomenon that you're seeing where various different humanities disciplines are being merged together as a kind of cost-cutting move. Essentially, the message coming from many universities is, you know, if Chaucer can't pay the bills as well as business and economics classes do, then Chaucer should simply be eliminated. And this is really a problem. I mean, universities have traditionally served an extremely important role in preserving our common cultural heritage. And these disciplines that may not appear to have any kind of short-term commercial profit or have any immediate application to the commercial sector obviously play a critical role in nurturing the kind of critical thinking and broadening of people's minds that is so critical to developing a democratic, educated citizenry. So it's really it's significant, this shifting of resources toward fields that either attract money, study money, or make money.
We're talking to Jennifer Washburn today, Media Matters, author of the new book, University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, just released fresh off the presses by Basic Books in February of this year. Jennifer, let me run a few points that are raised to me when I have discussions about this topic with family members of mine who are less concerned about commercial involvement in all facets of our life than you or I seem to be. They will say isn't this a good thing because all this money that corporations and commercial interests bring to universities to stimulate research will create a whole branch of research that wouldn't exist otherwise?
You know, there's some merit to that, and certainly I wouldn't turn off the spigot. I'm nowhere in my book do I say that industry should stop funding university research. But the problem is that universities have to be much more vigilant about insisting on their own academic autonomy. You know, we've already sort of touched on it, but it's really extraordinary how much universities are allowing industry to dictate the terms of the research, and that is really troubling. In the case of clinical research arena, universities are allowing the industry sponsors to actually control the raw data from their clinical trials. And so what that means is that when it comes time for the academic researcher to sign their name to an academic paper, they don't even actually control the data on which that paper is based. That's a degree of industry penetration and corruption of the purpose of the academy that is something I think we really can't accept, because the public relies on universities to provide us with research that is disinterested and that is driven by science and not by just one company's bottom line.
How far down this road are we? I mean, do you have any sense of what percentage of the research would, in research universities, for example, would qualify as being, you know, proprietary at this point?
You know, it's hard to get figures like that. Part of the problem is that the federal government doesn't keep track of any of this patenting and licensing activity. It's really amazing. But the universities set up their own membership organization called the Association for University Technology Managers. And literally all the data that we have about patenting and licensing of federally funded taxpayer research is controlled by this organization that is really run by the very offices that are profiting off of this federally funded research. So, you know, you'll see in GAO reports occasionally the government will acknowledge, well, you know, there's a problem here because we're relying on the universities themselves to self-report. But we do know that it's really quite significant. I mean, in the sciences, increasingly you're hearing more and more complaints from people, even in industry, but also economists, legal scholars, historians of scientific innovation, are concerned that the basic building blocks of science are being patented and licensed in ways that don't actually serve the public interest. They're actually really the university is motivated by maximizing its own royalty income.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a lot in the second half of the course, because you really have a much stronger critique, not just of the research process, but of the broader implications for what this means for universities and colleges and how they affect everyone in the community, not just scholars and business.
Yeah.
And I definitely want to get to that in the second half of the show. Our guest today is Jennifer Washburn, author of the new book, University Inc. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Jennifer Washburn, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And I will get to the phone lines in a second, but I want to follow up on your last point. You know, what we're seeing, as you argue in the book, is that the notion of having a knowledge commons in which research goes into a body that anyone is welcome to use, and the point of scholarship is to enhance the broader understanding of the entire community and raise that level and let anyone draw from it, is really no longer the rule increasingly, because proprietary research is the exact opposite of that. It puts fences around research and says you can't come in. It goes to only to certain people who have access to it. And one of the points you make in the book, I think, which is striking, is that the idea that this is justified because company A comes in and pays a scholar to do this or gets some sort of arrangement really misses the point. There's a tremendous amount of public investment that company A is taking advantage of to do this in the first place.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, this goes back to your question before. Do we have any sense of the total amount of research that's influenced by industry now? Although industry still only supplies about 7% of the overall research budgets of universities, it's estimated that it influences somewhere on the order of 20 to 25% of the overall research budget. I think that's probably somewhat conservative, but the reason that the influence is so much greater is that a lot of the industry money is being used in tandem with state and federal funding. And so the minute that industry money is involved, it then becomes the proprietary property of that particular industry group that's funding it. So let me give you an example.
At
UC Berkeley signed a major 5-year, $25 million agreement with Novartis, a Swiss-based pharmaceutical company and producer of genetically engineered crops. And when Novartis signed this deal, essentially they were funding up to 1/3 of the research budget of an entire department at a public university. In exchange for that, UC Berkeley let Novartis have first rights to the research coming out of that department, and that included research not only funded by Novartis, but research that was funded by state and federal sources as well. So that's the kind of subsidy that industry enjoys when it finances research at the university.
And there is a chapter on that you call a new kind of uprising at Berkeley in the book, University Inc. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Our guest again on Media Matters today is the author Jennifer Washburn, author of the new book, University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Jennifer Washburn.
Yes, I wanted to respond to that previous caller about CIA research on campus. It does go on. We've had it here at the U of I. Professor Seitz, Professor Zinnes in the political science department, and indeed a good deal of the political science department was at one point in time on the payroll of the CIA. Professor Donchin at the psychology department had $1 million contract with the CIA to develop a better lie detector test for the CIA using students as guinea pigs. The College of Veterinary Medicine had an enormous contract from the Department of Defense to develop biological weapons. Larry Schmar over at the National Center for Supercomputer Applications had a big contract with the Department of Defense, again, to use our supercomputers.
Are these more recent, or are you referring
to... I'm getting more recent, sure,
okay.
to develop the next generation of ICBMs, a cutting edge of our nuclear arms race. And now over at the Beckman Center, our so-called biotech research facility, it appears that a good deal of the research over there is intended directly to benefit Monsanto and other biotech industries. I think, you know, it's one thing, I'm not criticizing you, I haven't had a chance to read your book, but for the listening audience to understand, this goes on right here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about corruption of higher education, and it's gone on here for quite some time. I believe it still is going on today as we speak. We need to have people send in Freedom of Information Act requests under the Illinois Freedom of Information Act to find out how many of our professors are on the payroll of Monsanto, how much is going into the Beckman Center, to what extent some of our professors are still on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. They're putting a lot more money now into professorships all over the country. And also on biowarfare projects, USAMRIID, that runs all the biowarfare. The former director is a graduate of our College of Veterinary Medicine. So there's enormous corruption, unethical, if not outright illegal contracts that have gone on in this campus, and whole departments have been bought off, and curiously, not surprisingly, skewing research, even questions that can be asked and debated, bringing in speakers, you name it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. Jennifer, I'm a faculty member here, and I have to fill out a form that sort of indicates any money I've gotten from anyone, and I assume it's a publicly accessible form. I mean, is there are some of these researchers that you're chronicling in your book, are they doing this entirely under the cover so even their own bosses don't know what's going on?
No. In fact, it's quite common that universities will have faculty report to the university, but this is actually a big part of the end of my book. It's amazing to me, but universities are not required to make that information publicly available. Even public institutions are often very closed when it comes to helping out a journalist, for instance, who wants to know whether Professor X at the Beckman Center that the caller just referenced has financial ties to Monsanto. That information is often very, very hard to obtain, and particularly universities are probably the last places that would actually publicly disclose that. I think that's a huge problem. I think that the federal government should actually pass new conflict of interest rules that would require any university professor who receives U.S. taxpayer funding to comply with much more rigorous conflict of interest and disclosure rules.
So this caller's got a very good point that there's a lot going on that we just don't know about.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. And I have to say, I find myself in this predicament all the time. I'm trying to, on the one hand, explain why it is that there are some very distinctive and troubling developments going on with vis-a-vis corporate funding of universities. But I don't mean to undercut or downplay the significance of government influencing of research and the direction of research. I think that is a subject that always needs to be watched and vigilantly monitored.
Well, he mentioned Monsanto, which of course is one of the leaders in biotech, which is another area of booming corporate influence and research, isn't it?
Yeah, Monsanto has had long ties, to many different universities, and I have to say it's troubling. But I do know that filing Freedom of Information Act requests, even at public institutions, many universities are very tight-lipped about these contracts. They claim that when they sign a contract with a company like Monsanto, that the contract itself is a proprietary document. And so I've actually encountered this myself, and I know other journalists who have been unable to get information about public universities that have signed contracts with private industry because it's claimed that those contracts are actually proprietary and may contain proprietary secrets.
Now, as you noticed from our callers already, the University of Illinois is near and dear to the hearts of many of our listeners as we were coming out of the University of Illinois. I looked in your index quickly to see if I missed anything. There's only a couple of references to the university in the book. Does this mean we've got a clean record here, or does it just mean that you were so busy looking at the other schools you didn't get down to here?
Yeah, it's just there are so many schools. There's on just the sort of top, research universities, there's over 3,000 of them in the United States. And, we have an extraordinary university research system in this country. Every state, has its own universities, flagship universities, and different levels of universities. So I simply couldn't keep up with all of them. The book is an attempt to kind of give a national overview and highlight some of the examples that are perhaps most illustrative of what's going on. But I really urge listeners and students and professors to take a closer look at what's happening on their own campuses and expose it, because you really are the best situated to research those things and get out the word.
We're talking to Jennifer Washburn today in Media Matters. Washburn is the author of the new book, University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Jennifer Washburn.
Hello. It's really great to hear this topic today, especially coming from WILL. It speaks to the independence of this station, because WILL is kind of a unit of the university, if you didn't realize that. But I wanted to mention a couple things about the pre-Bayh-Dole. There were actually individually arranged agreements between institutions and the government because there was no kind of default agreement for this kind of thing. So the pharmaceutical industry kind of pioneered the model that was put in place by Bayh-Dole, which allowed for exclusive licensing. And the contention over the issue of public dedication of publicly funded R&D actually dates back to the interwar period, if not before then, but certainly it was a huge issue during the interwar period. But in terms of the University of Illinois, it's actually on the frontier of this kind of thing. It's not so much that the U of I is on the frontier, but I think the privatization, commercialization effort its frontier is at the University of Illinois, which is a land-grant public university. So the fact that it's happening here is, if it's happening here, then where wouldn't it be happening? And to give you an idea, there's, for instance, here there's an Office of Technology Management, which there's kind of an edict that goes out to researchers on campus that anything they develop, especially in the areas of information technology, which I'm more aware of, anything they develop they can't release that or share that with outside parties unless it first passes the approval of the Office of Technology Management. And what that means is that they assess it for marketability. And then what they've done is they've sent up a venture capital firm here called iVentures, which is there's several venture capital firms in town, but iVentures happens to be the one that's approved by the Board of Trustees. And then there's an incubator firm for startup companies that come out of the research enterprise here, and that's called EnterpriseWorks. And during the last few years, millions of dollars of U of I funding has flowed into this technology transfer framework. During the same period, where we've seen all this belt tightening and complaining of budget cuts and various things. So I just wanted to put that in perspective.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, caller. That
is exactly what I've been documenting, not at the University of Illinois, but just throughout the country. This phenomenon could be replicated at virtually every research university. They're pouring money into these new venture capital funds, incubators, industrial parks, these very expensive patenting and licensing operations, all while the share of state budgets that are going to fund the general budget for higher education has dropped by more than one-third just since 1980. So you're really seeing a kind of, you know, transfer of resources over to these new commercial functions that is extraordinary. And you know, given at a time when public support for higher education is waning.
You know, we have a full bank of callers to talk to you, Jennifer Washburn. But first, I wanted to touch on one issue that's very important in your book. You get to it several times, and we haven't really discussed it here. And I want to make sure our listeners are familiar with it, which is the effect all of this has, in your view, upon undergraduate education, teaching, and also the balance between the humanities and social sciences with the health sciences and what are called the hard sciences.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked about this. I think it really is essential to the argument of the book. I mean, there's a larger question here, really, about what is the place of higher education in our society? You know, do we still consider higher education to be a public good that's worthy of investment and support? And do we still believe that the primary function of the university is to educate students? And increasingly, I believe that the answer is clearly no. You know, when you see this kind of shifting of resources to the commercial sphere of the university, and at the same time this remarkable downsizing of teaching, universities are adopting a cost-cutting model that is really centered on eliminating full-time professorships and increasingly hiring part-time adjuncts and graduate students to handle virtually all of the undergraduate instruction. These adjuncts and graduate students are paid meager salaries. They often receive few, if any, benefits. They have no long-term job security. So in terms of the downsizing of the professoriate, this is an extraordinary way of undercutting the heart of the university. And, you know, today nearly a half of the faculty in higher education work on a part-time contingent basis. 60% of the new faculty hires are off the tenure track, meaning that they have no, they are not on any track to be eligible for tenure.
You know, Bill Gates, the CEO and founder of Microsoft, recently gave a talk that's gotten wide distribution on the internet and elsewhere on the state of high school education in the United States. I don't know if you happened to see that, Jennifer.
No, I didn't.
It was just in the past 2 weeks. But one of his arguments, and I don't know if he wrote it himself or if he had someone ghost it, but at any rate, his argument was that the vast majority, you know, our high schools are failures, and one of the problems is that it's a class-based system where we go into it thinking that the vast majority of the students who are in high school are just there basically as a holding pen until they can take menial jobs, and they aren't really trained to think critically or at all. Just that's really a really relatively narrow segment that will go to elite universities and be expected to use their brains.
Mm.
Do you think, as I hear your argument, as I read the book, I was wondering how that dovetailed with, you know, what you see going on in higher education. You're talking largely about elite institutions that have strong research components, but if you extend it down to the next 2-3 tiers of higher education where most college students are attending, the situation in many ways might even be more grim.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. In some ways, I think the students that are at these research universities are being the most misled, let's say, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, the fact that they think they're getting this high quality education, they're paying top dollar and think they're at one of the more prestigious institutions, but it's very unlikely that they're going to get to see any of the full-time professors that are responsible for the prestige at that institution, because so much of the teaching is actually farmed out to these adjuncts and graduate students. So in some, you know, some will argue that you could actually get a better education going to a smaller, you know, two-year school where you're more likely to actually have teachers who are committed to teaching.
But by the logic of the argument you're saying, the working conditions as you go farther down the pecking order of academia, it's not like those professors are sitting around, you know, dandelions in their hand sipping white wine while they talk to the students. They're, you know, they're hectored with enormous course loads. And
Yeah. I mean, generally, you know, this phenomenon of the downsizing of teaching is happening across the board.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, we're living at a time where nobody is defending the need for, you know, we have to pay taxes to finance our education system, and we have to insist that these are public goods that are worthy of support. And So you know, on the one hand, I point the finger at the universities, but I must say that they are facing financial constraints, and they're also facing enormous pressure from state governors and legislators now to become engines of economic growth.
Yeah, what would happen to, let's say, the president of a major research university who's read your book or listened to this show and said, darn it, she's absolutely right. She's hit the ball over the fence. How much leeway does the head of a university have, or is there such a strong confluence of pressures upon a university administrator that really there's not much they can do short of organize their collaborators to change the whole system?
You know, I think that there's obviously a lot that they could do, certainly first by starting to speak out about some of the contradictions here. I mean, you know, I want to make this point at some point that at the same time that universities are pouring these money into these commercial operations, the vast majority of the nation's universities do not make any significant profits off of all of this patenting and licensing activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that university presidents and leaders need to be more honest with governors and state legislators and their regents. Obviously, they are under an enormous amount of pressure, but even if you just look at it from a financial perspective, it's hard to justify this skewing of priorities.
We're talking to Jennifer Washburn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jennifer Washburn, author of the new book, Universities, University, Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. We have a full bank of callers, and I promise I will get to all of you. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Jennifer Washburn.
Hello. Thank you. I just bought your book about a week ago, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But I want to commend you because this is long overdue. I want to piggyback on a couple of previous callers about the University of Illinois. There are some things going on here as well that weren't already mentioned. There's something that just started up that's called the Academy of Entrepreneurial Leadership, which is housed in the Business College, I believe. And I don't really understand what their purpose is. But in addition to that, you know, we just hired a new president who has a business background. And on February the 22nd, there was an article in the local newspaper that the vice chancellor's office turns to marketer. They've hired this fellow who marketed Uncle Ben's Rice Bowl, and his job now is to market the university to Fortune 500 firms in terms of having them collaborate with research on campus. And I read, I think it was in Friday's student newspaper, there was an article about a researcher on campus who is doing some research on biodegradable chewing gum. But the reporter never did mention who paid for that research and where that money's coming from. So I noticed that happens a lot in reporting. It seems to be a question that's never asked. And I did skim through your book a bit, and it seems to me that, at least in the first chapter, I think you mentioned some student newspapers that really did some excellent research and brought out some information about corporate corruption. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm realizing that if only I'd had access to all of these callers when I was researching the book, I had all kinds of leads on them.
You know, my guess would be, Jennifer, that if you did this interview in any research university town, you would have a similar bank of callers.
Yep. I think this is true. I mean, there's the stories are just abound, and it's just a question of bringing this more to light because so few people realize what's happened to these research universities and just how extensive the commercial reorientation of the university's priorities really is.
You know, what I'd add to that, though, is that we are a land-grant university, as are many of the great Big Ten universities, which means our public subsidy at our founding and our commitment to service to the entire population of the state is in our charter at a much greater extent than it is virtually any other public universities, not to mention private universities.
Yes. You know, I want to get back to the caller's question about the role that students play. I think he might be referring to students at Harvard University organized a group called Harvard Watch.
Mm-hmm.
And they just did a wonderful research exposing the various different ties that various Harvard research institutes have to various industries. They did a particularly good job exposing something called the Harvard Electricity Policy Group, which was heavily funded by Enron and various other energy companies.
Mm-hmm.
And during the time it was receiving this funding, it churned out roughly 31 reports promoting the deregulation of energy markets in California, precisely the kind of market deregulation that Enron would later profit from. So that's just one example, but I think students are incredibly well situated to start to ask questions and push their administrators to publicly release information.
You know, you talk a lot in the book about the sort of the market model that university administrators are increasingly adopting, and that of students being sort of, I forget your term, the customers, the parents are the customers, the students are the clients.
Right.
You know, and then there's coursework is the content providers that professors provide. Are parents and students, I mean, are they against this, do you think? I mean, do you sense that there's a hostility there, or are they sort of part of the program? Because I think there are a lot of professors that are really comfortable with this. The ones who certainly benefit from it, from my experience, are not especially critical of this process.
Yeah, I think there's a real problem. I mean, this whole notion that education is a product, students are the customers, sets up a dynamic where it's really all about just consumer satisfaction. And historically, that isn't really what higher education was all about. I mean, students came certainly with certain interests and talents, but part of the purpose of higher education was to broaden their intellectual horizons. And in order to do that, you had to expose students to areas that they might not otherwise be inclined to explore. And so I think it's a real shame to degrade education in that way. And I unfortunately think that a lot of parents are complicit in allowing that to happen because they increasingly see higher education as a product that they have purchased, and that it is by and large something that is geared toward advancing their child's economic prospects in life. And although universities certainly have always and should perform that function, I think there's not enough awareness about the broadening of people's minds, expanding their capacity to think in ways that are creative and new and really enhance their growth as an individual.
We have three callers who have been waiting very patiently, and I want to make sure we get to each of them before we go off the air in 7 minutes. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Jennifer Washburn.
I agree with her completely with what she just said. If one did, however, take a product model and they asked themselves, with all the money going into universities from corporations, why has the tuition kept pace with the inflation rate? I would like to mention that when one goes to university today, after going through registration, the next tables over will be the ones to sign up for credit cards. Currently, there's a bill before the Congress about with the Orwellian name of the Bankruptcy, Abuse Prevention, and Consumer Protection Act. But I think it's under the radar of most folks that if you get into serious debt with credit cards, or I don't know, I'm getting off the topic, with student loans, you can't declare bankruptcy. But on top of that, to keep up with tuition today, students are getting into deep credit card debt. I wonder if you all would talk about that.
Thank you very much. And if I can just put a something from the book that struck me as I read it, Jennifer, that he alluded to. College campuses, I mean, following sort of business commercial model, are increasingly looking like commercial areas and with strip malls in a way, with brand names and chains and sort of student union buildings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really a very different climate than, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago, or the traditional sense of a campus sort of removed from commercial life.
Yes, no, I was so struck by that. I just recently actually did a reading at the University of Maryland, and I went to their student center, and the place just looked exactly like I'd walked into a mall. It was filled with, McDonald's and Taco Bell and Cinnabon and various different other fast food chains. There wasn't anything other than fast food chains providing food there. There was a movie theater, and then I came to find out that the bookstore which had no, there was no sign on the outside indicating this, but the bookstore was in fact run by Barnes & Noble, which is happening. Most college university bookstores now are being taken over by Barnes & Noble. So it's absolutely true. The credit cards, I don't know as much about that area. It's not something I...
Let me one point he did raise. I mean, tuitions have been skyrocketing at the same time that all this corporate money is coming in to universities. Would tuitions be that much worse if there was no corporate money? Would they be even going up faster than they currently are?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the industry funding is just not benefiting the students at all. I mean, the industry funding is going to finance research that has much more direct application to the industry's research.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. We only have a few minutes left. Line two, Champagne, you're on the air with Jennifer Washburn.
Yes, I did want to point out that since the University of Illinois is a state institution, unlike private universities, it is governed by the Illinois Freedom of Information Act, which is quite good. So what people need to do is to get a sample Illinois Freedom of Information Act request from the American Civil Liberties Union and then fill it out and say, look, I want access to all contracts involving Monsanto or the CIA or the Department of Defense, or biological warfare contracts, or whatever you want, and send them in. They have to comply. If they do not, you just have a friendly local lawyer make a phone call, say the ACLU, and they will comply.
Well, thank you very much.
You can also get access to professors' annual reports on activities by means of the Freedom of Information Act request, and they are very useful to find out for whom, what agencies, what institutions, and what corporations professors are working for. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very helpful call. We have time for one last call, a very patient person. Line three, on your car somewhere. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm not a U of I faculty member, but my husband is, and I just wanted to mention that the form that you alluded to in regard to the outside income does not go to the university. My recollection, having helped him fill it out in the past, is that it goes to the state of Illinois, and the penalty is quite stiff if you don't turn it in. It's something like $1,000 a week or, you know, $500 a day or something like that. So I'm sure that everybody makes it a point to get that form turned in on time. The other thing I wanted to mention is that the partnerships between the university and various corporations is physically very much in front of those of us who live in Champaign-Urbana. I live close to the Southwest University Research Park, which has Motorola there and the Center for Supercomputing Applications and so forth and so on. And that's clearly going to expand. And then there's another university research park. You know, I think this is like this big elephant in the room, and I think nobody has really raised until, I think, you know, the issue of this book. People have talked about it sort of privately, but I think that the coverage you've given this issue may help to bring some of these issues to the forefront and may force some of those people, I hope, to be more upfront about the relationships and to keep it more in the sunlight. And
caller, so I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background. Can I ask you quickly, what department is your husband in?
Mathematics.
Okay, thank you very much. Jennifer Washburn, we only have a few seconds left. How has the response been to the book so far?
You know, well, by and large, the response has been good so far. You know, I get a lot of support from people on university campuses who I think feel like they haven't really had an outlet to discuss these issues. And so that's been, I think, the most rewarding part of writing the book.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jennifer Washburn, for being our guest today on Media Matters. Jennifer Washburn, the author of the brand new book, University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, just out with Basic Books, and a terrific and read on an invaluable subject of great importance. My name's Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today, 167 hours, with the next installment of Media Matters. I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer, for doing the great job as always. See you then. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Devro TPAG in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny, breezy, and warmer with the high in the upper 60s and southwest winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, gusting to 40 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy during the evening, then mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain after midnight. The low in the mid-40s with southwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the morning, then a chance of light rain in the afternoon. The morning high in the mid-50s, then temperature falling. Northwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.
Today's broadcast is made by